every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.
People's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being!
Warning! When the operation of the machine makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. And unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio, broadcasting from an undisclosed location somewhere in the woods of western Wisconsin. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing on all sorts of dissidents, heretics, and other interesting individuals with points of view way outside the Overton window of the mainstream institutions. One of those institutions is, of course, the Academy. I've spent some time there myself, actually. I was institutionalized there for quite a while, actually. And tonight we're bringing on some refugees, or you might even say escapees, from the institution. The second hour tonight, Professor James Fetzer, history of science guy, philosophy of science guy from the University of Minnesota Duluth. And of course, they probably don't want us breathing the name of their institution in the same breath as Jim Fetzer. We'll come on to discuss his appeal to the Supreme Court in Posner v. Fetzer, and he'll also have things to say about all sorts of other things, including the truckers getting their bank accounts frozen, and, of course, what's going on in Ukraine. In the first hour, another free-thinking academician is joining us. That's Michael Rechtenwald. He became rather well-known. In fact, he had the same kind of 15 minutes of fame that I had a while back. In both cases, we scandalized people by saying things you're not supposed to say, and the media picked it up, and colleagues, at least a few colleagues in my case, freaked out. But ultimately, in Michael Rechtenwald's case, it seems that free speech prevailed to a certain extent, which is more than you can say in my case. In any case, Michael Rechtenwald has been putting out all kinds of great analyses, and most recently, he's been talking about woke capitalism. It's great stuff, highly recommended, and it's an honor to have him on the show. So welcome, Michael. How are you?
Great, Kevin. How are you? Good to be here.
I'm doing well, and I'm always happy to have you on the show. I really admire your work and the way you stood up to the forces of conformity and mediocrity in the academy and are still calling it the way you see it. That's what I thought we were always supposed to do, but silly me.
Yeah, that was supposed to be academic freedom, which is great as long as you don't use it.
There you go. Yeah, that's kind of freedom in general, in fact. And, you know, that underlines a kind of a contradiction in the guiding philosophy of liberalism, which says that the individual's pursuit of happiness, according to whatever criteria the individual wants to pursue happiness, it's none of society's business, really. They're all at the same level, is the be-all, end-all, and ultimately the only value that society can be organized around. And that's led to all sorts of craziness, both free market craziness, where corporations do whatever the heck it takes to make a profit. But now woke capitalism is coming along, telling them that you have to conform to these various sorts of liberal progressive shibboleths. And I think that's a failed attempt to reform liberalism, and it's not going to work. Liberalism is going to collapse. Would you agree with that?
I'm not sure about liberalism. I don't even know what that means anymore. But I think what's going to collapse is the economy, based on what they're up to. It's a very pernicious intervention that they're making into the economy to basically force conformity upon these companies and to essentially. Totally dictate to them, and I can talk about what kind of development that's going to bring about economically. I think it's going to collapse under its own weight. It's such a mammoth undertaking that they're doing.
And you know, if you'd asked me 20 or 30 years ago, would it be a good idea to have corporations consider the effects of their actions on others, on the people around them? And stop just going for the bottom line, I would have said, well, of course. But the way they're doing it now, it seems questionable at best.
Yeah, I mean, they're using all of these euphemisms to describe what they're up to. Stakeholder capitalism, you know, it's all about the environment and social justice and so on and so forth. But you know, I've just seen this movie before, Kevin, and the way they use language and the way that they basically it's double speak. You know, what they say and what they do are two different things. And I think it's engineered to set up monopolies even greater than we have right now. This more monopolization, more power to the corporate heads. They're actually going to have governmental power. Beyond what they already do, they'll be dictating to citizens what they can and cannot do in conjunction with the state. So it's like the worst of both worlds, really, in terms of capitalism and communism. We have Giorgio Ambegin has called it communist capitalism. I call it a corporate socialism. But whatever you call it, it's not good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And it seems that even some of the people who are behind it are backhandedly admitting that it may not be so good. You analyze that Super Bowl ad where a kind of a stand-in for Klaus Schwab, pretending as Dr. Evil, is told that he can take over the world, but he should save the world first and then take over the world. And that kind of summed up the whole thing, didn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly the agenda. I mean, they act like they're coming to the world's rescue, but it is the most thoroughgoing surveillance state and control that you can imagine. I mean, they just want to have control over everything and everybody, including basically all the natural resources, which will all be digitized and given a digital identity and the Internet of Things, and each person will also be a digital entity that they'll have all the information on. The digital ID is something that the WEF, the World Economic Foundation, which Klaus Schwab heads, is touting all this stuff regularly right on their website. There's nothing hidden about this agenda.
And it seems that we're in a whole new world, because I remember not so long ago, just a few decades ago, when there were these wiretapping statutes that made it I think it was a felony to wiretap somebody. And what does wiretap mean? It means to intercept their telephonic communications. So you listen to somebody's phone call, you tap their phone, what have you. That's wiretapping, and you go to prison for it. And today, our electronic communications are being wiretapped constantly by all sorts of spies. I mean, they should, all of these people doing that from, you know, the heads of Facebook and Twitter and the other internet oligarchs, those people should all be in prison for wiretapping, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, they're doing more than wiretapping because they're not only tracing our vocal emissions, if you will, they're also tracking all of our web searches. Google has all these records on every single person. They've profiled them. They have everybody has a profile, and they actually not only record your every move on the internet, they also try to dictate what you'll do and what you'll think by feeding you a certain order of news and certain news items and completely banishing others, as we know so well, right, Kevin? I mean, probably we've both been downranked by Google so many times we can't even count it because, we're calling them out on what they're doing, and this is mis or disinformation or malinformation or whatever they call it. Whatever we do is just deemed misinformation and disinformation and utterly dispensed with. So they're controlling consciousness, really. It goes further than, you know, just knowing what we're saying. They're trying to control consciousness. I don't think they can achieve it, because if people can see what they're up to and that, you know, can see through it, they retain their consciousness and they retain their autonomy over their own thoughts.
Indeed. I think if we do go back to that pre-internet reference of, you know, what people could do and couldn't do in terms of spying on other people's telephone conversations, and then recognize that the internet is just a larger, more powerful telephone connecting everybody with everybody else. And back in the days of AT&T, it was illegal to listen in. It was illegal to tap in and grab data about what people were saying and then use it to predict and control their behavior. That would have been beyond the ultimate Orwellian nightmare in those days. I mean, nobody would even imagine that humans would ever stand for such a thing. And so if we go back to that model and recognize the internet is just a big telephone connecting everybody to everybody else, nobody has a right to wiretap or collect any data whatsoever from anybody's private phone calls or internet communications. Nobody has the right to make a telephone work better for one person or another. They all have to be on the exact same level playing field. You know, if we introduce that concept and then put some really heavy penalties, and I would suggest capital punishment for violators, maybe we could change this. You ready to get behind that?
Well, I don't know about capital punishment. I'm kind of like against that, but it's
even for Zuckerberg.
I'd rather be tortured with his own techniques to see if we could gaslight him to death like he's trying to do to us.
Okay.
But you know, I mean, they are. What it comes down to is, you're right, it's like wiretapping. It's very much like wiretapping. And if the internet is a utility, which it should be considered, I think, a utility, and most of these platforms should be considered utilities as well. Never did you get thrown off of a phone by a phone company off of your line for saying the wrong things. Never did you get censored by your own phone company. Never were you, you know, basically policed for your statements by the phone company. They connected you and they let the conversation go. They let you
even
alone,
if you spread misinformation.
I don't. Yeah, right. I mean, here's the thing. We know that this is doublespeak, right? Because they're the ones that are perpetrating the misinformation and disinformation. That's a propaganda a machine that we're up against, you know. And it takes almost everything in your power just to stay sane under this assault. I think the assault is so unremitting that it just takes a control. You know, it takes so much effort just to maintain one's own perspective and to also resist this kind of constant barrage of propaganda, doublespeak, and gaslighting that we're being subjected to.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is almost a full-time job just resisting the brainwashing and staying sane. And then one thing that drives you even more crazy is when you see friends and family who succumb and you know, get washed over the waterfall with the propaganda and become completely stark raving bonkers. And it's interesting how so many personal relationships have been damaged by this propaganda.
Indeed. I've seen it in my own family. One telling the other one to get vaccinated and a fight ensues and now they don't speak to each other. Things like that. Yeah, it's really terrible.
And speaking of the vaccination issue, did you see like the last, like just today, two new news items crossed my electronic desk. One of them, I'd seen a little bit of this before, which is that it looks like Pfizer and Moderna's stock is cratering, presumably tanking, because investors have noticed some of the data about the harmful effects of these vaccines. And then the other is that a Swedish study, I think it was, showed that it turns out that these mRNA vaccines actually do this reverse transcriptase thing where they basically alter your DNA and you could keep on, you know, it could be altered in such a way that you keep making spike protein indefinitely or how, you know, in ways that they didn't intend. Did you see that stuff?
Yes, and more. There's other things too. The Scottish data, which has now been squelched by Scotland, showing that people with the who have been vaccinated, double vaccinated, and triple vaccinated are faring far worse in every area, including infection, sickness, and death. So it's all showing to be a complete charade. And yeah, Moderna's stock, I think, is down 70%. There's a very smart guy that's been that was a BlackRock, Inc. Investment manager, portfolio manager. He has blown the whistle on this and says all the smart money has already left Moderna, and most of it is starting to pour out of Pfizer as well. And he's saying that really what he thinks all of these totalitarian measures we saw in Canada, that we see in Canada, he thinks it's more than power. What they're trying to do is get ready for the kind of uprising you might see when the economy completely collapses and social security and pensions are threatened by the market crash. This is really possibly what's happening here. And of course, now we have a global, situation with war. And this is another way of, I'm not saying that this war was begun to distract or deflect from all this, but it's certainly doing that, isn't it? It's doing that trick nevertheless.
Yeah. I actually got an email from Ron Unz a couple of hours ago saying, you know, I may have to admit that you vax skeptics were right, you know, citing a couple of these stories. And then saying, you know, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I would wonder about the timing here. You know, just this war breaks out just in time to distract from all the bad news about vaccines and the trucker convoy and on and on.
Yeah, just when they were saying, you know, it was what, I guess 18 months ago, 24 months ago or less, you know, that the vaccine would change your DNA. And people said that was insane. What a crazy idea.
That's like David Icke saying that lizard people rule the British throne and things like that. Yeah,
that's right. Just like that. Or, you know, the ruling class is really, you know, an alien force. You know, these are not really humans. You know, no, this is very simple. This is mRNA, which obviously, interlaces with DNA and makes it function. So how could, you know, why would you think it's so far-fetched that mRNA injected into your body to do a certain thing would not mess with your DNA and make for some sort of replication that we don't want.
I didn't know myself. I was kind of, you know, I don't have enough of a background to feel very confident about, but I did read some stuff early on that made the case that it was not at all implausible that it could actually alter DNA. And now it looks like that's true.
Yeah. What do you know? So what is the conspiracy, but something that's basically said 6 to 12 months early, in effect.
Yeah. So how come we conspiracy theorists aren't making fortunes shorting the market, shorting Pfizer and Moderna?
Well, you got to have. For my case, I don't have the capital to do it. So yeah. I mean, if I did, if I could turn a couple thousand into a couple million, I guess I would. I mean, you know, but I don't have that to risk. So those that have the risk, maybe they are taking advantage of it. Like this portfolio manager, his name is Dowd. I forget his first name, but he's D-O-W-E. Worth following on Twitter, by the way. He is really on to the economic aspect of what's going on. And then he extrapolates from that to the political, which is very interesting. I think he's doing a fine job.
And there are a number of people like that, these investment watch types who are kind of both, you know, doing the conspiracy beat, the thing that I do, and then the investment advice beat, which is quite different from what I do. But it seems to come together a lot more than you would think.
Absolutely. What I do is I look at financial news a lot more than I used to. I look at financial news because it doesn't hide anything. It really doesn't hide anything. You can see who owns what, how they're all connected, what's going on with various stock, of course, but also, you know, the kinds of interlacing between these various players that they can't hide once these financial transactions have gone down. And so you can track and trace what's up with all of these things. And, you know, speaking of which, you know, Larry Fink has been a special case for me. I mean, this guy is running, of course, he's a very big player with the WEF, but of course he's running BlackRock Inc. And he's also running the Fed, in effect. He is literally running the Fed. So he's telling them, and they're instituting the policies that he says to put in place. They're in a deep dive in terms of debt. I mean, it is some unbelievable. And so they've got to find a way to get out from under this debt. And one of the ways they're doing it is by inflation, because they're trying to pay less money. So one way to pay less money is to make more money, so that what you buy, for example, if I bought something from you for $500 a year ago, and I was, or maybe $15,000, I say, I was making payments over time. Well, if you devalue the money, that product's value has just gone down. So that's what they're doing. They're inflating, they're instituting inflation so that what is owed is really much less. If I pay you $1,000 today, it's a lot different than a year ago. So that's what they're up to.
And what do you think of an analysis like from Michael Hudson? He thinks that the big economic struggle is the class war, not so much between the proletariat and the capitalists, like Marx said, but between the borrower and the lender. And the lender always has surplus money. That's why they're a lender. The borrower doesn't have enough money. That's why they're the borrower. And that history is a series of cycles of struggles between these groups. And from that viewpoint, one could argue that the inflation is helpful to a lot of borrowers, harmful to the lenders, and therefore it's actually helping the ordinary folks more than the wealthy. Of course, most of us don't like inflation, and there are people on fixed incomes and pensions, of course, who are badly hurt by it. But there is that argument. You know, I even hear it from some of my leftist friends that, oh, inflation isn't so bad. It's actually, you know, good for people like us who are in debt.
No, there's some truth to that. I would have to admit that there's some truth to it, because like I just said, if I'm paying for something that I paid $15,000 for over time, and I'm paying like $1,000 a month or something like that, then that $1,000 is worth much less than it was when I bought that item, and that $15,000 is really worth less. So this is one of the reasons that they're carrying a lot of debt themselves. And you know, as you very well know, the money is made up out of thin air anyway. They just make money out of nothing, then they lend the money. This is all purely, totally autogenesis here. There's nothing behind this money. It's completely fabricated. So they can do anything with this they want. And the Fed has changed changed a major policy in August of 2019, when they started basically, instead of just giving money to banks, they're actually giving it directly to what they call the retail market. So this is changing everything, and they're trying to control this out of control situation in which they have trillions and trillions of dollars of debt, and they're not able to recuperate.
Well, you know, there's another kind of analysis that holds that the reason that we've been able to basically keep growing economies using this bizarre system that's based on usury, which all mm-hmm. of the ancient wisdom tells us is evil and unsustainable. And obviously usury right. is mathematically unsustainable. If you create your currency by lending it into existence at interest, there's mathematically no way that it can ever be paid back. And the exponential nature of the interest, compound interest, means that basically the lenders end up with everything. So that's why there's been such a strong prohibition of usury historically. But mm-hmm. we've had usury dominance. The oligarchs are basically the big usurers. It's been that way for well over a century now. And the economies have grown and grown and grown. And people like James Howard Kunstler, who was on this show, was it last week, I think, or the week before, argue that it's been possible because of fossil fuels, which have provided energy that then causes real economies to grow exponentially right along with that exponential interest in currency creation. But we're reaching the end of that now. We're hitting peak oil and so on. And the woke folks who tell us that we can easily transition to renewables are kind of living on another planet where the physics is different.
That's right.
Yeah, so you would agree with that.
I agree that I'm not sure about peak oil. I just don't have enough evidence to speak on that. But I would say that what they're trying to do is transitioning to these renewables is not going to work. I mean, there's no way we can generate sufficient energy using renewables. And they're driving all these corporations into it and punishing those who don't go that way with this ESG scoring. That's the environmental, social, and governance score, which is basically meant to starve out non-compliant organizations, companies, corporations, and to reward the others. So it's a cartelization method in order to create a cartel or a number of cartels, and to basically stave off competition and control all the market and thin down the herd of competitors. That's what I think they're up to.
I think you're right. And it's an interesting way to do it, isn't it? To sort of monopolize moral virtue and use that as an entry barrier.
Yes. They just decided on this one. You know, I read a really interesting article actually by a Marxist who talked about wokeness and how, you know, it's basically being used, like you said, as a shibboleth. And, it, you know, in terms of like getting into the elite, there's an overproduction of elite aspirants. And so they're using wokeness as a way to eliminate people. Well, they used to do sword fighting, you know. So it really is arbitrary in some sense. In terms of the economy, it doesn't look as arbitrary because there's this climate crisis, supposedly, and I think it's well overblown. I think there is some change in the climate, but I think this catastrophism is completely a pretext for gaining further control and for instituting like draconian austerity measures for the masses. You know, don't eat meat, you know, eat insects instead. Basically, don't drive anywhere, you know, and so on and so forth. So there's a massive effort on the part of the elite to really reduce our income and to reduce our expectations, to reduce our prospects, to reduce our consumption, and to reduce basically everybody to a sort of what I call actually existing socialism on the ground with oligarchs on top. It's the most bizarre amalgam imaginable.
So it's own nothing, eat insects, and you'll be happy.
Yeah. You'll be happy. And you'll have no privacy. They also said that. You'll have no privacy, but you'll love it because you don't need privacy. What's it for?
Wow. So we all have to be basically exhibitionists, taking great pleasure in being spied upon.
Exactly. And you'll feel so good about yourself if you're in total conformity with the powers that be, because this is the one way to identify with them and to identify yourself in terms of them, which is really another function of wokeness, is to be able to identify with the elite and to feel like you're part of the elite. You know, this is what they do to academics. You know that very well, the way they use this kind of shibboleths and other methods of entry into the so-called elite status. And they're really just controlling you that way, and you're not getting anything like that. You're not really part of any elite. You're just made to feel like you are.
Right. Yeah, well, that's partly how they get away with paying you so little when you're sort of at the entry level in graduate school, and then your first teaching job and things like that. And of course, people in the academy are notorious for investing all kinds of ego in these little trivial territorial disputes with their fellow academicians. I'm sure you've seen some of that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. People taking claim, and the niches are so narrow and so absurd, you know. Mm-hmm. The things that I see people writing about, I'm still a member of various academic platforms like academia.edu and ResearchGate. And what I see these people spending and pouring their lives into is the most arcane nonsense imaginable. It just strikes me as so absurd and pitiful, really, that this is being done to people, or they're submitting to this, really, to have such a trivial, specific concerns for such absurd, arcane niches that really mean nothing, right? That really have no consequence whatsoever. So I'm real happy to be out of the academy myself, in the sense that I can do what I want and say what I want and actually pursue the kind of things that I think are more important than that.
Well, you know, in Don DeLillo's satirical novel, White Noise, the professor hero has kind of created the field of Hitler studies, which was pretty hilarious back then. But now you look at that and you'd say, well, you know, Hitler was actually an important world historical figure. So that, you know, that guy was not quite as ridiculous, even in the satirical novel, as a lot of real life professors are today with their bizarre sort of non-binary, queer, this, that, the other stuff, makes Hitler studies look pretty respectable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kind of things that are passing for scholarship right now, it's beyond belief. I mean, you don't have to really have any – what you have to do is you have to master this plug-and-play jargon and just, you know, basically these are almost pre-formatted, you know, pre-formatted writing, because you just take, like, throw a few of these things together, like heteronormativity, and cisgendered this and that, and just throw these things together, and this passes for scholarship. This is what's going on.
Yeah, I think some of the humanities people may, and the social sciences people in particular, you know, they may have looked at some science journals, and they know, hey, the scientists and the mathematicians, those are the really smart people. And so they look at what those guys do, and it's totally indecipherable. It all just reads like jargon. And so they say, hey, well, we're going to have to just, you know, invent some jargon too, so our stuff can be just as tough to read as theirs.
That's a very good point. I think there has been a lot of mimicry of the scientific fields by the humanities and social sciences, particularly the social sciences, as you said. But in the case of science, what they do is they create terms in order to really kind of isolate things, isolate objects, and then they have more – it's a tool to manipulate these objects, whereas in humanities, they don't think language has anything to do with reality. Thanks to deconstruction, the idea that there's this disjunction that can't be breached between language and the world it describes. So they just go free for all with this nonsense.
Yeah. So how long can a culture that doesn't believe in truth last?
It's a good question. It's really been eroded significantly, subverted, I would say, really. It's been subverted, and so we don't have any – you know, we're in a, besides all the other crises we have, it's an epistemic crisis. We don't know what the hell is knowledge anymore. We didn't even know how to, you know, we're basically the leadership, I think, are postmodernists, okay? They have mastered postmodernism, whether they read it or not. They are basically using it as a way of making things so crazy that we have this difficulty finding the truth. And then they basically suggest that there is no truth, that everything is just subjective, and there's just your truth, and then there's my truth, and there's Sally's truth, and then there's Sally becomes Sam's truth, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of an epistemological solipsism that they've put us into, tried to put us into, and it takes everything in one's power to continue to try to pursue knowledge and basically, you know, in pursuit of the truth.
I don't know if you caught Putin's latest speech about the empire of lies. That was his most rip-roaring speech yet. And I think he nailed it in several respects. And one of them is, I think that phrase, the empire of lies, is really good. That's something I would like to copyright. Like, I wish I'd copyrighted the term false flag, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I started doing False Flag Weekly News. And now the big media would have to pay me a nickel every time they said it, and I'd get rich.
Oh, wow. That would be great.
Yeah, they were accusing Putin, you know, of planting all these false flags. And there was that one press conference where they were saying that he's got this whole thing filmed. He's got like all of these very realistic bloody atrocities that he created in some Moscow version of a Hollywood studio, and he's going to break it out and say that, oh, there was this terrible attack on Donbass and blah, 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 and false flag. I said, wait a minute, this is like the mainstream media is starting to issue these false flag warnings. They're stealing our stuff.
I saw that. That's very interesting, isn't it, how they have actually appropriated that language. And now, you know, because anytime that was used, that was deemed, you know, that basically was a red flag that you were some kind of conspiracy theorist if you used that phrase. Now they're using it. This is what I mean about how they appropriate and also then twist and gaslight us with this kind of language that they're putting out. And I think that's a brilliant phrase, empire of lies. I mean, if you look at the Ukrainian situation, which I'm not an expert in, but I do know that we undertook a coup there in 2014 and installed undemocratically basically a neo-Nazi regime, and who was very, very, very bellicose and very also very, very had a great deal of animosity towards Russia. And this started the new policies towards Russia, and that started their torture or their kind of a campaign against the people in the regions of Donbass. And this is certainly a pretext for what's happening right now. I am not exonerating Putin at all. That's not the same thing. I'm saying that they established conditions that helped to give Putin the reasoning or the rationale to do what he's doing right now.
If you put yourself in the shoes of someone like Putin or the American leaders of the empire, you know, our platonic guardians, either way, you know, you realize that they have to be pretty crazy, borderline psychopathic, or in some very warped way, you could even call it heroic, I guess, if they're trying to keep their values to be in that position. You know, you look at, I don't know if you've read like Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, where he describes his RAND Corporation work looking at the U.S. nuclear command and control chain, discovering that the situation was like worse than Dr. Strangelove. You know, he discovered throughout the 50s, U.S. Right. doctrine is the second war breaks out, we're going to fire everything we have not only at Russia but also China. So 5 minutes after hostilities commence with Russia over, like, people start shooting at each other in Berlin or something, we're going to murder more than 500 million people instantly, like inside of an hour and a half. 500 million people in an hour and a half. And we're going to kill everybody or almost everybody in China, too, along with Russia. Why? Well, they're communists, too, and why not? You know. So right. That was the doctrine. And then so how do we make sure that somebody doesn't start this by mistake? Well, theoretically, the president has his nuclear suitcase and he has the only button. But what if they nuked Washington? You know, the Soviet embassy has a portable nuke in there, and they could just take out Washington whenever they want. So we have to devolve that command chain, either down the command chain, give those people little nuclear buttons themselves, and come up with these kinds of Rube Goldberg contraptions to try to make it so that each of these thousands of subcommanders, down to like staff sergeants stationed off in Bali or whatever, that has this nuclear button, actually couldn't just use it anytime they wanted. But it's just insane. And so anyway, it's my point being, the poor, you know, Putin, he sees NATO is coming up with these better and better, faster, more accurate first strike weapons and pushing them closer and closer to Moscow.
Right.
You know, if you were in that position, what would you do?
Yeah, this is the Cuban missile crisis for Russia, in effect. You know, basically, they want to put nuclear weapons right on the border. So, you know, 150 miles from targets. So this is very, you know, it's a very precarious situation, and you know, there was absolutely no negotiation on the part of the Biden administration about this. They wouldn't concede a single thing. They wouldn't even acknowledge the facts, of course. So yeah, that's what NATO wants to do. They want to subsume Ukraine to bring it in and then post nuclear weapons on the border of Russia. So this is what he saw, and I'm not exonerating what he's doing. I think it's dreadful. I think it's horrible, and I don't approve of it. But you have to look at it rationally as what kind of stupid people would basically antagonize an actor like that.
Well, they're playing a very high-risk game, I guess, and I'm sure they wanted this. I mean, I think it's quite possible that one reason they decided to really provoke Putin right now and then not even go to the negotiating table and basically, you know, force his hand is that, as you say, there's a debt crisis, and now they can get away with trashing the economy and won't be blamed for it because it'll be wartime measures. That it distracts from the complete failure of these vaccines and the news about the vaccines. It turns out they're just as bad as the conspiracy theorists said, or at least some of the conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
They haven't killed everybody. So anyway, it seems to me the Western Empire controllers wanted this war and pushed the right buttons. Whether they wanted it as big as this, I don't know. And where they want to go with it, I don't know either. But I don't believe there's sort of one all-seeing eye in the pyramid that's controlling everything. But I do think that very often these wars are partly created by, you know, not by the obvious person, in this case, Putin. I don't think this is a war that Putin particularly wanted. I think it was predictable that this was going to happen if you push enough buttons.
Right.
And they wanted it.
Yes, absolutely. I can't help but think that, you know, look, if they didn't want this to happen, they would have been prevented. So I have to think it's the same way that you do about this. This was actually intentional in some sense. They actually wanted to precipitate this kind of conflict, and probably for some of the reasons you're mentioning. And it's a huge distraction, but it also provides an alibi for their previous misdeeds. So it then takes the eye off the ball about all these domestic issues and the fact that we see totalitarianism on the rise. You know, you saw it in Canada where they're confiscating people's property for a protest and freezing their bank accounts and really unpersoning them entirely. I don't even know if China does that. You know, I mean, they do put people in basically concentration camps. I'm not sure that they totally unperson people like Canada is attempting to do, and they back down on the Emergencies Act, its permanence. I think Trudeau got a call from somebody at the World Economic Forum and said, slow down. This has to be incremental. We can't do this all at once. People have to, this has to be so incremental that it's basically imperceptible. And that's really what I think they're doing. It's a kind of imperceptible encroachment upon everything, all of our rights and our property and everything else. And they'll take it away little by little, but not real fast, because if they do it fast, people will notice too much. If you lose a little bit of rights, a little bit of mobility here and there, little by little. You know, it's the boiling frog. It's kind of a cliche, but it's true.
So Schwab called up Trudeau, said, Justin, you've got to boil the frog a little slower.
Listen, we are going to do the great reset, but we cannot proceed at this pace. Please slow down with all of these emergencies acts, sir.
Well, that's what
you did learn at the Young Global Leaders was patience, my son.
Oh, yeah. That's what Jim Fetzer is going to talk about in part in the second hour, too. Yeah, he just published something about that. So, yeah, well, the wartime thing, you know, whenever war breaks out, that's the end of civil liberties. You know, a lot of people don't realize that here in the United States, Eugene Debs had to run for president from a prison cell in 1918 or whatever it was because it was World War One. And if you spoke out against U.S. involvement in World War One, you could go to prison like Debs did. And World War Two wasn't much better either. So here in the United States in war, and then, of course, the Civil War, Lincoln was rounding up anybody that opposed that war and just throwing him in prison. So I wonder whether there isn't a conscious decision being made high up somewhere that, you know, look, this empire is falling apart. We're challenged. You know, China is challenging us economically. You know, Russia is challenging us militarily. Islam is challenging us ideologically, but we kind of slowed that down a little bit with our 9/11 false flag. So we're going to have to wage a war here, just like, you know, almost all empires do when they're being challenged. There's the Thucydides trap that they fall into, and it's going to happen. So let's go ahead and do it, and we're going to have to get our population in line with the program for the war. So let's start getting rid of the freedom in time to try to corral people into support for this war that we're going to fight. So I see a transition to wartime conditions, an attempt to regiment the population behind a war agenda. And I just wonder if it's going to work. And I wonder if Putin maybe didn't start stuff a little faster and bigger than they expected, because Putin recognizes that they're going to have a hard time right now rallying the entire population unanimously behind a war that a lot of the Trump demographic is very skeptical about it. Mm-hmm. But of course, they've tried to get the left totally brainwashed, and they've largely succeeded. You know, usually the left is the source of anti-war sentiment, but now they've neutralized that, and they've turned the left into a bunch of jackbooted, mindless marching thugs.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I didn't want to have to be the one.
That's true. You always get in trouble for saying stuff like that, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think? Are we entering wartime conditions?
Yes, I think that's right. And every time we've had a war, World War One, World War Two, afterwards, the whatever civil liberties that were abdicated in effect never come back, and that's really, I think, what's up. I think that this is definitely moving towards wartime mentality, and therefore sacrifice and all that sacrifice, you know. And don't you, or are you a Putin puppet otherwise? If you have anything to say about this engagement and this potential conflict between the U.S. and Russia, then you must be a Putin puppet, which is really interesting, because isn't this a reversal? You have the left effectively now the ones crying Russia, 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 whereas, you know, during the McCarthy era, it was the opposite. It was the other way around. You had the right calling people for their Russia, Russia, Russia and their communist sympathies. Now we have the opposite going on. We have a leftist McCarthyism underway.
Could this save Biden politically? I mean, it looked like he was going under. His numbers were abysmal, and the economy is pretty dead in the water with inflation taken into account. And everything was shaping up for a huge Republican victory in the midterms and probably in the next presidential elections. And maybe it's even Trump coming back. And, of course, certain folks probably wouldn't stand for that. So, anyway, do you think that this, you know, World War III, Putin equals Hitler thing is going to pull the Democrats' bacon out of the fire?
I think they can do whatever they want, because at this point we're dealing with a uniparty rule. I don't think there's any efficacy coming from the so-called other side, and I emphasize so-called, because I think, you know, with the number of neocons you have on the right, basically – this could definitely consolidate or rationalize, because I don't think there'll be a real election. What I think it'll do is give him the rationale for saying that he won, for making it, you know, say, well, he won because he, you know, because of the way he handled Russia. And that'll be a way to justify the election fraud that they'll undertake, because I do think they engage in that.
Well, that's possible, but I just wonder if in a year or two, Biden's handling of Russia is going to look very good. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I mean, he's not able to put a sentence together, so he's going to have surrogates in there, you know, basically becoming the mouthpieces of this. I mean, they may put him out for a few statements, like, you know, a few a few utterances of moral indignation here and there, but he doesn't have the capability to communicate anything in any effective way. So it has to be done by others, and then the military, of course. What will they do? We'll see. I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine them actually. Well, I can see them going into Ukraine very soon, actually. I don't think they'll go into Russia. I can see them doing that, yeah.
Ooh, what else? Well, I hope you – do you have a fallout shelter in your basement?
Yeah, I mean, seriously. I mean, you know, we could all be toast, literally, because, it, you know, it could be serious conflagration here.
Wow, yeah. See, I don't know. When Biden sort of assured us that he wasn't going to fight for Ukraine – I was believing him, but of course I was believing Putin when he said that he wasn't doing the all-out invasion either. So who knows?
Yeah, but everything Biden said he's, you know, reversed. I mean, he has never said anything that he's, I mean, basically they'll say anything at any given time, whatever works at the moment. But now that Putin's attacked, this looks different. This gives it a different complexion. So his countermeasures, everything he said before will be just forgotten. And the press is already pushing him to say more like sanctions are, I mean, sanctions haven't done anything. What are you going to do? You know, they're already trumping up this possibility of some sort of military campaign. And, you know, the neocons are definitely itching for it. And so is all the military industrial complex, all the weapons manufacturers who need more and more money spent on munitions. So I wouldn't be surprised if some kind of engagement happens in Ukraine itself.
Now, have you seen any calls for the U.S. to actually go into Ukraine? I don't think I have yet.
Not yet. I haven't seen that yet. Mm-hmm. They have to first, show the carnage and so forth. So they're going to fuel the outrage. And, you know, there's some reason to be outraged. It's not a good thing when people are dying, but who knows what's really happening? That's the other thing. We don't really know what's happening, and there's a lot of exaggeration, so it's hard to tell what's what. But, I haven't seen calls for arms yet, but I don't think it's far off, frankly.
Mm. Wow. Well, I hope you're wrong, because
me too.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely, you know, a lot worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that leads me to a topic that I brought up recently and took a little bit of flack on from the right thinking folks, the few that still actually subscribe to my newsletter, which is, you know, I wrote this piece for American Free Press about how what we should really be worried about isn't COVID, it's nuclear war. And,
yeah,
you know, just did some elementary mathematics. And the New York Times tells us that for a vaccinated 75-year-old, that person's chances of dying if they contact COVID are about 1 in 200. And that was before Omicron. Now with Omicron, it's 10 times lower. So now it's 1 in 2,000. So your vaccinated 75-year-old, who's pretty much like an unvaccinated maybe 55-year-old, has a 1 in 2,000 chance of dying if they catch COVID. Well, I mean, that's not good because, you know, 1 in 2,000, that's, you know, in a population of 100 million people, it's not good. But it's not the end of the world either. On the other hand, the odds of nuclear war each year are reliably estimated at between 0.3% and 3%, oscillating around, you know, sort of an average of, what, 1%. And so now it's got to be at least 3%, if not higher. And if what you're saying is true, it's going to go a lot higher than that. Are we crazy to run that risk or what?
Yeah, I mean, it would be crazy, but I think they could. I mean, look, Putin made a gamble that we wouldn't do anything nuclear. And so they could make the same kind of calculation that nothing nuclear would take place if they escalate, if they go into the conflict itself. Now, they may not go in with ground troops, but they may do some bombing. They may do some airstrikes. That would be hard to figure until there's some sort of an occupation of sorts, or there's some way they can target the Russian troops directly, which I think they can with the kind of missiles they have, you know, these smart missiles and so forth. So it's very possible that they could make some strikes on Russia. It's not out of the realm of possibility. And depending on how much pressure is put on by the neocons and the press, the war-hungry press, I wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibility. I don't like it. I don't like the prospect one bit. But I can't see how when sanctions fail, which they will do, because Russia has no need for Western goods. I mean, they can do a lot of deals with China and still be fine. So I don't think that the reliance on the West is devastating a prospect of losing as is imagined, or maybe feigned, for better words, maybe feigning the idea that they believe these sanctions will work. And then when the sanctions do nothing, they could then say, well, what are we going to do? He's continuing and the sanctions aren't doing anything. And then the rationale for some sort of a conflict, entering the conflict and engaging, is there.
I guess that's all too plausible. And the sanctions actually not only do nothing, they're counterproductive in the sense that every time the U.S. imposes sanctions on somebody, all of the players in question
lose
up together and say, how can we get out of the dollar? Let's build new.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true too. They try to get out of the dollar, which would be devastating to the American economy because the American economy is dependent on its being the lingua franca of the world ever since Bretton Woods. So this is very significant, could be a very significant blow, which could then again be another trigger. So that's another thing to think about.
Well, it is, and you've given us a lot to think about, and you gave me something new to worry about. I hadn't even really seriously entertained the likelihood of the U.S. actually taking NATO into the Ukraine to fight Russia. I hope that's
Yeah, I don't think it'd be on the ground, but it could be airstrikes of some sort.
Oh, boy.
I
mean, that wouldn't be good either. Well, no. I think we're hitting the end of the hour. Thank you so much, Michael
Rechtenwald. My pleasure.
Appreciate your great work. Keep it up.
Okay, thanks. You too, Kevin.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's Michael Rechtenwald. He's the chief academic officer and co-founder of American Scholars. And he's taught at many institutions, including NYU. Back with another dissident professor, James Fetzer, talking about his appeal to the Supreme Court in the second hour. This is Truth Jihad Radio, truthjihad.com.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday, 1700 hours Pacific Time, that's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, broadcasting live from the proverbial undisclosed location somewhere deep in the woods of western Wisconsin. I'll give you a hint. I'm very close to the Wisconsin River. Hopefully that can't be used for targeting information for those drone programmers up at Camp Douglas or Fort McCoy. Anyway, here we are, wherever we are, and let's get going here with the second hour. And by the way, if you like these radio shows, please do subscribe to my Substack. You can find it by going to truthjihad.com and clicking on the subscribe at Substack button. Okay, let's continue with our conversation with dissident academicians. After Michael Rechtenwald in the first hour, we're moving on to Professor James Fetzer in the second hour. Jim Fetzer is well known in alternative information circles. He's done very important work on the JFK assassination. He founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and he has gotten heavily involved in the Sandy Hook case, leading to a series of court battles. And I guess it's going to culminate at the U.S. Supreme Court, inshallah. So let's talk about all that and more. Hey, welcome, Jim. How are you?
Well, how's my favorite truth, jihadist, my friend? It's been a while. Great. Terrific.
Yeah, I'm still throwing those verbal bombs and grenades as best I can. So, good to have you back, Jim.
No,
so.
It's wonderful to be with you. And, of course, you were there. You wrote an absolutely splendid piece on the legal lynching of a truth seeker, Jim Fetzer, Stalinist trial-styled show trial. Kevin, I think that captured the situation I was in better than anything else anyone else has written. I thought it was just a masterpiece. And, of course, it was on Oon's Review. I think that That is just a wonderful publication, and I'm glad a recent piece of mine, What's Wrong with Conspiracy Theories, has been published there, too, and I expect to make other contributions, but I thought you captured the core of my case exactly.
Well, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I was kind of shocked, actually. I mean, I went into that courtroom preparing to be actually a fairly fair-minded, relatively neutral and impartial observer, even though I'm a friend of yours, but I'm one of these weird people that's I like to think of myself as often being pretty good at sort of setting aside things and just kind of trying to look at what the reality is or what are the facts of the case. And, you know, I'm still pretty agnostic on Sandy Hook in general. So I just thought, you know, who knows what's going to happen here. I wasn't really expecting the Stalinist show trial with the blatant emotional manipulation and the obvious prejudice of the court. But, hey, you know, it is what it is.
Well, Kevin, you got it exactly right. And, of course, you were there for the summary judgment, which is only appropriate in a case when there's no disputed facts. In other words, summary judgment is really an extraordinary measure when all the judge has to do is to determine how the law applies to a case where the factual foundation is not in dispute. The situation was precisely the opposite here, because the key question over which I was being sued was the authenticity of a death certificate I'd published in a book, which had been provided by, guess who, the guy who was a plaintiff who brought the lawsuit against me for a purported defamation, who calls himself Lenny Posner. He'd given it to Kelly Watt after they'd had 100 hours of conversation where Lenny had reached out to her. I think he wanted to find out how much those of us doing research on Sandy Hook had been able to sort out. She told him repeatedly she didn't believe a word he said, didn't believe he had a son, didn't believe his son died at Sandy Hook. And eventually, I mean, this is very late on in this 100 hours of conversation, he said, check out my Google Plus page. And when Kelly went there, there were several documents. There was a copy of a passport for Noah Posner. There was a kindergarten card for Noah Posner. And there was a copy of a death certificate for Noah Posner, which had no file number, no town certification, no state certification. In other words, it was an uncertified death certificate, which Kelly shared with me and which I would publish, and Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and in a chapter she and I had co-authored, but where it also appeared elsewhere in the book and in a blog where I assisted Robert David Steele in putting together a memorandum on Sandy Hook for then-President of the United States, Donald Trump. I also asserted there what the court found to have been false and defamatory, at least defamatory. Whether he ever declared it to be false is a good question, but of course truth is an absolute defense. So if it wasn't false, then I couldn't be found in defamation. So I was sued over four sentences that made a certain characterization about this death certificate for which I was being sued on the alleged ground of defamation. And you may or may not be aware, Kevin, but in the complaint that was sent to me, to Mike Palachek, to Dave Gaharry, where Mike was the co-editor, he actually had picked the title of the book and written a prologue for it, whereas I had edited the book, brought all the contributors together and written Mike had written a preface. I'd written a prologue, which gives a summary overview to the entire book, and where Dave Gaharry is the publisher of Moonrock Books, they attached a death certificate that was completely unlike the one published. It had a file number, it had a town certification, it had a state certification, and yet in the complaint it claimed they were not materially different. Mm-hmm. Well, material difference is one that makes a difference from the point of view of the law, and you could hardly have any features differing here that were more materially different than the fact that file number where one had, one didn't, town certification, one did, one didn't, state certification, one did, one didn't. In fact, Kevin, this case is so absurd that I would eventually learn that Connecticut even have a law that not even parents are allowed to have an uncertified death certificate. Well, when I received this complaint, I thought it was an opportunity to get the massive evidence I'd accumulated with 13 different authors in the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill to promote gun control, published on 22 October 2015, and had sold nearly 500 copies when it was banned by Amazon on the 19th of November. Where recognizing this was political, I wasn't going to get anywhere with Amazon arguing about it. I immediately released it for free as a PDF. And where a dear friend who follows these matters has suggested it has been downloaded as many as 10 million times. Well, apparently they wanted to cut that off. And the reason for bringing the lawsuit against me was to get a judgment that they could then use to go to the various sources that were distributing the PDF for free and threaten them with a commission of defamation or contempt of court, given that I'd been found guilty of defamation.
Well, you know, that strategy strikes me as kind of stupid, Jim, given the Streisand effect, where, you know, a free PDF on the Internet is so easy to copy and spread around that the more you scream and yell, get that thing off the Internet, get that thing off the Internet, the more people wonder why and the more they look at it.
Well, they didn't make that motivation explicit, Kevin. You know, it was supposed to be that I defamed him by presumably implying that he was a liar. Actually, I made no declaration in the book anywhere about Lenny Posner, the motivation, the circumstances. I merely said the document was non-authentic. And by the way, I'm now under a court order, so I cannot reaffirm what I was found to be in defamation. I'm only reporting to you what the lawsuit was about without being able to make that assertion. But would you believe, when we had the scheduling conference and I'd already laid out in my answer the massive evidence I had that we had, that 13 contributors, including six PhD professors, that we discovered the school had been closed by 2008, that there were no students or teachers there, loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, that we'd even discovered the manual for the FEMA exercise, which had been confirmed on the ground, how there were porta potties in place in advance, pizza, bottled water available at the firehouse, everyone wearing name tags with, you know, on lanyards, parents bringing children to the scene. I mean, think about it. What parent is going to bring a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre? Zip, zero, zilch, none, not one. I mean, it's insane. But because this was the rehearsal day, this was a two-day exercise for which we even discovered the manual, which I included as Appendix A in the book for a mass training exercise involving children, mass casualty exercise involving children, where events on the ground confirmed it, that it was an exercise. There was even a portable sign that said everyone must check in. Well, right in the manual, it says everyone must check in with a controller upon arrival. And in fact, one of the contributions of Wolfgang Halbig, whom, as you know, is a very admirable guy. He's a former Florida state trooper, former U.S. Customs agent, former school principal, nationally recognized school safety expert. He initially believed it was all on the up and up, that all these kids had died. So he began making inquiries so that he could instruct other school systems on what steps they should take to make sure it didn't happen to them. And he noticed that his FOIA inquiries weren't being replied, his phone calls weren't being returned, and before he knew it, there were two detectives, homicide detectives from the local precinct on his porch in the gated community in Florida where he resides, telling him they were there on behalf of the Connecticut State Police, and if he kept asking questions about Sandy Hook, he would be prosecuted. Well, Kevin, that's so absurd on its face, and his motives were so pure that he turned into a bulldog to go about pursuing this. And, of course, he has been, like myself, like James Tracy, others who have sought to expose the truth about Sandy Hook, been severely punished for speaking out. But where Wolfgang, in the continuous perseverance of his case, was able to organize a formal hearing with witnesses under oath, and while Monty Frank, who's a local attorney there, was telling people that even though they had a summons to appear, they didn't have to appear to try to sabotage what Wolfgang was doing. Wolfgang got Patricia LaLorda, who is the first select man of Newtown, a position equivalent to mayor, to acknowledge under oath that the Homeland Security had placed a sign there. Well, Homeland Security shouldn't have had anything to do with it. If it were on the up and up, it was a school shooting that was a state offense. No role for Homeland Security. But since FEMA is a branch of Homeland Security, it was actually confirmation it had been a FEMA drill. We have all this other evidence on the ground.
It's interesting that you point the finger at FEMA, because with 9/11, we also had FEMA coming in right before 9/11 and holding this huge terror drill, envisioning a big anthrax attack. And they hired thousands of off-duty police officers and other city workers to play roles in their play acting of a gigantic anthrax attack hitting New York City. These were the Tripod 2 bioterror exercises, and they were scheduled, I think it was for Wednesday, and then 9/11 happened on Tuesday. So FEMA was already there in New York and all set to go. And that does make me kind of wonder about the role that FEMA could play in these kinds of things. Although, again, my caveat for the listeners is that my interpretation of Sandy Hook is a little different from yours. I'm not fully convinced by the book and the evidence I've seen you present. And I wouldn't be surprised if something fishy around Sandy Hook has been distorted by a lot of fake evidence that's been generated to, you know, fake images of porta potties, perhaps fake images of schools that look like they've been shut down for years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to obfuscate the actual reality, which is probably pretty bad already. And then also to allow for the kind of witch hunt that's targeted you and it's been such a huge influence on the wave of internet censorship. I think of all of the events that have happened during the past 20 years, the Sandy Hook and then the Sandy Hook Truth Movement is number one in terms of providing the public relations pushback that has allowed this huge tidal wave of internet censorship to just come out of nowhere since about 2016 or so and wash over the entire internet. And so now we're living in an internet censored world where Google and all of the algorithms, all of the social media companies are all shadow banning everybody. They're deplatforming people. The free internet is dead. And the single biggest force behind that is the counter narrative, or the pushback against the Sandy Hook counter narrative. You and others have been demonized as unfeeling, heartless types who don't care about these poor parents who lost their children. And these court cases against you and Alex Jones and so on have been used to foster that impression. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of this whole situation has been partly manufactured precisely to create a public relations excuse to crack down on the so-called conspiracy theorists and censor the internet.
Well, you have a very unexpected take to me, because the authenticity of all those photographs isn't really in doubt. I mean, there are hundreds of them. You couldn't have faked all the photographs we have of all the citizens who were turning out for this festive occasion. The porta potties were there in place. I've asked detectives whether they ever heard of porta potties at a crime scene, and they laughed. They thought it was ridiculous. And, of course, the day of the shooting, it further confirmed that this was a drill. There was no surge of EMTs into the building. There was no string of ambulances to rush their little bodies off to hospitals. Triage tarps were put down, but no bodies were placed of anyone even wounded, much less deceased. They didn't call the medevac helicopters, which they do even for a drill. And just, you know, there are so many points to be made here. The street, there's only one entrance into this alleged elementary school, Dickinson Drive. It was so jammed with vehicles, you couldn't have got an ambulance in there if you wanted to, nor, and this is particularly telling too, could you have got a bus in there, because according to the official report, there were, by Stephen Sadinsky, who was the Danbury State's attorney on the shooting at Sandy Hook, there were 489 students there. If you subtract 20 for the alleged decedents, that's 469, plus some 70 cafeteria staff members, janitors who needed to be evacuated, but no evacuation took place. I mean, it's just absolutely stunning. So,
yeah,
you know,
so there is a long list of these kinds of items, and I've gone over them, and some of them I've seen debunkings that appear to be successful, others not so much. So there's overall, again, I have to end up being kind of agnostic about what actually happened there. But what I am sure that I saw with my own eyes is that your court case was not a fair kind of process. And so I wondered about whether when you were scheduling and stuff and you met with Lenny Posner and some of the other guys, Mike Polacek and Dave Gary, were also being sued from Moonrock Books. And Dave ended up believing that Lenny lost a child at Sandy Hook. But anyway, during that kind of conferencing, it sensed the whole suit was all simply, you know, limited to this argument about this death certificate. Couldn't you have just gotten out of the whole thing by saying, okay, that death certificate that I saw earlier that I reported in the book was not authentic? It didn't have any of these authenticating data or marks on it. I had good reason not to think it was authentic, but now you've shown me one that looks kind of similar and has all these marks. So can I just stipulate that this new death certificate that you brought me appears to be authentic? And would you be satisfied with that, Lenny, and just go away? Did you try to do that? And if not, why not?
Because it's not true, because the death certificate they attached was fake just as much as the one that I declared, though I'm not allowed to say it. I obtained the
sorry, I just made you say it.
Kevin, I obtained the Dave Gaheri obtained another copy of the death certificate from the town. I obtained another copy of the death certificate from the state. We had altogether four death certificates before the summary judgment hearing, during which the Posner attorney introduced a fifth, and I had two forensic document examiners review them, and they concluded not one, not two, not three, all four were fake, Kevin. All four were fake. So there was no, I was in this for the truth, right? I mean, that's what I am. I'm a truth junkie. I want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So I was not going to compromise. And as a consequence, the judge, now this is the fascinating part that we don't want to leapfrog, which is this, at the scheduling conference, the judge made the declaration that while he understood that I did not believe that this had been a bona fide event, listen to this, he wasn't going to let me introduce the evidence. Here's what he actually said. He made this unambiguous, clear statement. Whether or not Sandy Hook ever happened is or not is not relevant to this, the truthfulness or the accuracy of the death certificate. Now, I understand the defendant's overall theory in believing that it never happened, and I'm not going to take the bait and let this case go down that rabbit hole. Now, in addition, his limited view was further indicated by his refusal to, quote, read your book because it would not be appropriate for me to start educating myself about the larger controversy. Now, what you have to understand, Kevin, is in the death certificate itself, it states the decedent died on 14 December 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary School of multiple gunshot wounds. So how can it be the evidence I have that nobody died at Sandy Hook is not relevant to the accuracy or the truthfulness of the death certificate?
Yeah, you would think that they would at least have given you the chance to, you know, at least, you know, bring, say, your best, you know, five arguments or items of evidence in there just to so you could have the right to show that you had a good faith reason to hold the beliefs that you hold. And that wouldn't have required the court to rule on whether or not your beliefs are true. However, it would seem that it's hard for the jury to decide whether you are in good faith in saying what you said about the death certificate in the book without having some understanding of why you might believe Sandy Hook happened the way you think it happened. I mean, that to me, that's there's a middle ground here between trying to litigate the entire Sandy Hook incident, which of course would be beyond the scope of that court, but versus, you know, shutting that out completely and not allowing you to bring any evidence to support your claim that you had a good faith belief about Sandy Hook and therefore about the death certificate. That's where I would say that the court was out of line.
Well, it's much more than that, because I wasn't allowed to introduce any of the evidence, which I'd already outlined to the court already in my initial answer.
Yeah, and they would interrupt you and shut you down and threaten you any time that you started to open your mouth and say anything about what you actually thought.
You're talking about in the trial. But remember, Kevin, yeah. Now that this was a trial only for damages. In other words, I'd already been found to be guilty of defamation in the summary judgment. Was a court that was just a judge ruling. The part you saw was only the determination of damages. And there, you know, the way they manipulated the evidence, I mean, it was simply grotesque. Let me back up a step or two, however, since we don't want to lose a couple of important threads here, which is the following. When the book was banned, the one party who took the keenest interest by far was Mike Adams. He actually published two or three articles about it. He did an interview with me about it. And when after 6 or 8 weeks after the interview, he hadn't published, I thought, well, maybe he'd abandoned it. Then, bing, there it was on May 6, 2018, by Mike Adams, the most dangerous mind in America, interviewed about false flags and extreme censorship. He recognized the threat that was posed by banning a book. I mean, the whole idea of freedom of speech is to protect controversial speech, not popular speech, which doesn't require any protection, but unpopular speech. Most people may have believed that 20 kids and 6 adults died at Sandy Hook. Here I had a compendium of 13 experts, including 6 PhDs, with a mass of evidence, including the manual for the event, that demonstrated conclusively, in my opinion, that nobody died at Sandy Hook. Now, it's the most elementary aspect of our system of justice that you cannot forfeit life, property, or freedom without a trial and where you're allowed to give a defense. But this jurist, this judge, would not allow me to give a defense.
It was almost like Alice in Wonderland, you know, or Franz Kafka, you know, watching you get sworn in. You know, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? I do. And then do you understand that if you speak the truth as you see it, you will be hauled off to jail?
Well, this is where you captured it so beautifully that I was the judge reprimanded me for speaking the truth when I was under oath. I mean, you got it exactly right, Kevin. I mean, that's one of the brilliant aspects of your piece about
that. It kind of puts you in a box, that's for sure. And another thing that makes me kind of suspicious about the official version of all of this is that it seems to me that with this incredible amount of effort and money that Lenny Posner put into tracking you down and Alex Jones and suing you guys and hiring all those lawyers and so on and so forth, with a pretty small fraction of that, it would be possible to produce a very slick, professional, detailed debunking of everything you say in the book. Well, I've looked at the debunkings that are out there, including some of Lenny's, and like I said, some of the points seem possibly valid or likely valid, others not so much. But it's all scattershot. You actually have to dig around and go through all these blogs and look here and look there, and it's all very confusing. And it wouldn't really be that hard to spend that kind of money that Lenny spent and put together one really good, thorough debunking of your book and put that out there on the Internet and make sure that it came up in all the search engines, which, of course, it would, because they would shadow ban you and they would hype it. And Lenny would have a really good way of defending his version of this if he did that. Instead, the debunkings that are out there are, again, scattershot and not very coherent, not really brought together in one place where an interested party can sit down and compare them to your assertions in the book. So why did he have to sue you?
Because he could not defend the official narrative and do what you have suggested doing, because the whole thing was fiction. The whole thing was a scripted event, and they botched things up. They didn't get things right, and there were many who were doing studies. Kevin, there are probably 500 videos tearing apart the Sandy Hook narrative that YouTube has taken down and banned because they were so devastating. So they had to do it in a scattershot fashion. That was the best they can do. So in addition, when I had produced my reports from the two document examiners who found all four of the death certificates were fake, that ought to have been decisive in requiring that the case had to be sent to a jury. They had to send it to a jury to resolve this disputed fact. Instead, the judge, during a conversation right before my very eyes, even before I'd been allowed to testify during the summary judgment, had the following conversation with the principal attorney for Posner. Well, you know, he says, if I exclude this evidence, then that'll be grounds for appeal. So I think I'm just going to set it aside as someone else's opinion. And that's what he did. He just set it aside. Here you have two, not one, but two document examiners testifying. All four of these death certificates were fake. That certainly raises a question of doubt.
Quick question for you, Jim. Did those document examiners say fake or just not authentic?
Fake.
Really? They all use the word fake?
I can send them to you for crying out loud. Okay. All four of them were fake.
I had forgotten that point.
Oh, yeah, they were very specific about it, and the judge just set it apart. Now, he's not entitled to do that, as I understand the law. Expert opinions have the same standing in a court as a judge himself.
So let's jump to the appeal. You appeal this to the appeals court and then to the Wisconsin Supreme Court so far. Am I correct?
Yeah. But I just want to add one further point that there was a question here about my status of a journalist, because if I were a journalist, then he had to determine that I had been somehow negligent in my publishing and reporting. But even though I gave him a 7-page accounting of my role as a journalist, I mean, you know, that I'd published 24-plus books in scholarly areas, that I had a 12-plus books in conspiracy research, that I had thousands of blogs, that I had all these radio shows, and not to mention the fact that I was being sued over sentences in a chapter of a book and a blog that I had authored and that I was the editor of the book. I mean, how could my status as a journalist be in doubt? But the judge never ruled, so he could slip over the fact that there was a higher standard of proof. In effect, get this, Kevin, they never showed that I had done anything wrong, and that's a necessary element of the offense. So it was improper to conclude I'd committed a defamation, because you cannot have a liability without fault. And they never showed I'd done anything at fault. So this case was just ridiculous on its face. If we have a break, we can take it. Then I'll hit you with all the appellate.
Well, actually, we don't have a half-hour break. We're going to go right on through to the end of the show, which is coming up in about 25 minutes. So you appealed the ruling. And how did the Court of Appeals respond?
Well, the Court of Appeals, in the second paragraph, quoted the official Sandy Hook narrative as though it were, you know, engraved in stone. I mean, it's just ridiculous. They begged the question. Now, it turns out they cited a couple of cases that had been resolved on the basis of procedural issues. In other words, there's been no court case that has dealt with the issue of whether anybody died at Sandy Hook. None of them. Not even this Remington thing, not the Alex Jones thing. None of the cases have dealt with the question. They've all been settled on procedural or other grounds, some kind of default. I mean, it was really the insurance companies that wanted to settle this last for $73 million, and I'm going to have a lot to say about
that. You're talking about the Remington lawsuit.
Yes, I am.
So why do you think they did that? Why didn't they try to introduce some doubt about what really happened?
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, that's in many ways, you know, that's a big bang for the buck what's going on here. A company named Cerebrus Capital has bought up a number of these gun manufacturing companies, including Remington. And Cerebus wants there to be these insurance settlements. I believe they're setting a precedent so that the public, and I think the enormity of the sum was crucial here, so no one could overlook it. Everyone starts thinking all of a sudden about liability. There's never been a case before when anyone was liable for a weapon and the way it was misused by a criminal. The criminals have been held responsible. I mean, suppose someone hits someone over the head with a hammer and kills them, fractures their skull and killing them. You going after the hammer manufacturer? or someone, you know, as we had in Kenosha, deliberately drives into a crowd with a car, you're going to sue the automobile GM, the manufacturer?
And of course, guns are quite commonly used in street crimes. And so if there's liability for the manufacturer every time a gun is used in a crime, that would be a good backdoor to gun control, wouldn't it?
Well, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to sneak it in into the way in which the gun was advertised, which I dare say may well have been Zebra setting it up by appealing to young men. I mean, this was the angle they used in this lawsuit, which was led by nine of the Sandy Hook plaintiffs, the first name which is Donna Summer against Remington. And you'll love this, Kevin. When I sought to intervene in that lawsuit to point out that there's never been a determination that anybody died at Sandy Hook and that that ought to be done before Remington shells out $73 million, not only did the Sandy Hook parents oppose my intervention, but so did Remington. Think about it. So did Remington. So the fact is that they're in on it. They're in on it. And it's just outrageous what's going on, which is why when I turned around and, you know, the appellate court was so ridiculous by begging the question that I had a very nice appeal to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And by the way, just for the benefit of the audience who won't know this fact, I was unable to locate an attorney to represent me during the trial stage of the hearing. It was only the trial for damages and after the summary judgment had been rendered that I was able to secure a Madison attorney to represent me.
How many attorneys did you contact when you were looking for representation during the trial phase?
Oh, Christ, Mike and I went through 70 to 100 easily.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, lawyers have a reputation for being willing to represent anybody, you know, Hannibal Lecter, whatever, psychopathic killers. But I guess you're worse than Hannibal.
Not if you're challenging the official narrative about Sandy Hook. So my attorney wrote a wonderful appeal, a petition to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and we were wondering why they were sitting on it. And in fact, they only released it when they had this judgment come down for the $73 million. So I'm convinced it was sitting on a shelf, Kevin, and they're just waiting for the right opportunity to drop it, where the $73 million settlement gave them cover. Remington never even reduced his reasoning for the judgment to writing, which is one of many. Let me give you issues for the U.S. Supreme Court where I'm going now, hopefully with help from the public. Issues for the Supreme Court. Complaint with different death certificates that were said not to be materially different, as I've explained. The scheduling conference, not going down that rabbit hole. This is most important because it denied the defendant his defense. He wouldn't let me present the massive evidence I had that no one had died at Sandy Hook on the absurd ground that it had nothing to do with the truthfulness or accuracy of a death certificate from someone who allegedly died at Sandy Hook. My status as a journalist was never ruled upon. He set aside the reports of not one but two forensic document experts who sided with me. He went ahead and made a summary judgment ruling when the basic fact of authenticity was in dispute. Let me say, by the way, a number of those who are familiar say this is the most ridiculous summary judgment they have ever seen, ever. A first-year law student would recognize this was outrageous and inappropriate, and yet the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in essence, allowed it to stand. He never reduced the reasoning for his decision to writing, as I've observed. The appellate court affirmed the official Sandy Hook narrative. They never took my case seriously, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court has now denied my petition for review. Let me just add, there's a fellow named Ron Avery out of Texas who knows a whole lot about defamation cases. He's put together a whole archive of the documents in my case. He was outraged by the appellate court treatment, and you can find his analysis to support the Sandy Hook narrative. Wisconsin Court of Appeals District 4 makes gross errors, which you can find on my blog at jamesfetzer.org. Now, there are a host of issues involved here, and I want to pursue further, but share with you a couple of observations. I did a show with Scott Bennett. It's called Great Awakenings with Stephen Pidgeon, who's a rather well-known attorney himself who takes on controversial cases. and he pointed out that it appeared to him there was a case for a deprivation of rights under color of law. In other words, the judge in this case violated my rights. He abrogated my constitutional rights under cover of law, meaning it was a form of dereliction of duty. Now, I'm given to understand that I cannot bring such a suit until I've exhausted all my other avenues, which in this case, of course, include going to the Supreme Court. Now, here's a letter, which I greatly appreciated, about the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. This was just, a week or 10 days ago. Jim, like you and no doubt many of your other supporters, I'm profoundly disturbed by the denial of your petition for review of the Posner versus Fetzer case by the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the terse manner in which it was denied, if terse is even the correct adjective. Well, I can read you what the Supreme Court said. A petition for review pursuant to Wisconsin statute 808.10 having been filed on behalf of defendant appellate petitioner James Fetzer and concerned by this court, it is ordered that the petition for review is denied with $50 cost. That was a totality. No reasoning, no explanation whatsoever. So I think he's got it right if terse is even the correct adjective. He continues, yeah. It is incomprehensible.
Yeah, terse is an understatement.
Yes. It is incomprehensible on one level how any court in the land could even begin to consider that this is a proper judicial denial, lacking as it is any reasoned legal analysis or justification for his decision. On another level, it is completely understandable given the state of utter corruption and capture we're facing in all sections of our government, legislative, judicial, and executive, and its agencies, plus the complicit corporate media, entertainment, and tech sections. I was certain that you and your co-defendants would prevail in this case when it first came up. It seemed like a slam dunk. But over the years, since you published your fine book on the subject, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and subsequently went through legal proceedings, it has become clear that the controllers involved will never tolerate a serious, credible threat to expose their frauds, deceptions, and criminal operations. And it is increasingly clear that they have the power to delay, cheat, obfuscate, censor, blackmail, bribe, and trap, propagandize, memory hole, etc., to prevent such exposures. He continues, as with the events of other real false flags and conspiracies you have covered, such as JFK, Wellstone, 9/11, Boston, Orlando, Parkland, etc., it sadly seems that truth about Sandy Hook will remain obscured to a lot of the general public for a long time, if not forever. Yet, notwithstanding this, I admire and applaud your determination to continue your efforts to bring out the truth about these events as you know it, to bring your petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, to continue to broadcast your shows, to continue to research, write, and sell books, engage in debates, celebrate, collaborate with other truth speakers, etc. He says some very flattering things at the end, which I greatly appreciate, but I believe are also true of others, including yourself. You are one of our few breathing national natural treasures, an honorable American public intellectual with the courage to speak truth in the face of corrupt adversity. That in itself is a unique contribution and job well done. I thank you for it. Please keep up the good work. Eric. That was a super letter I wrote to Eric and said he made my day, Kevin, because, I mean, he was showing the kind of appreciation for my efforts that I greatly appreciate. But going to the Supreme Court is a rather challenging task. There are a lot of filing fees in a law. You have to pay the attorneys. So I'm doing all of this on my own. I have had to establish now a fundraising site, which coincided with what the truckers were doing. So when, GoFundMe stole the truckers' money, I realized GoFundMe was obviously not the way to go. They'd actually obfuscated, they'd taken away $2,000 that I'd accumulated in the past by simply pressing a button and returning it to the donors.
Yeah, they did that to me too. Yeah, go F me has been
Go F me. I agree, Kevin. Go F me. So I realized that Give, Send, Go was the way to go. So I've established now a crowdsourcing for defending the First and the Second Amendment at Give, Send, Go. And here's a concise 1 minute or less summary of the situation I'm in.
Okay.
My book, so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill to promote gun control, presented as mass murder. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny, and it's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com funding Fetzer. Check it out. Noah Posner did not die at Sandy Hook. And what you would
see... Are you allowed to say that, Jim? Because when I was in court with you, you know, that you were being threatened with all of these injunctions that you're not allowed to say this and not allowed to say that ever, anytime, in or out of court.
Kevin, I'm just not allowed to make assertions about the death certificate, okay? And the fact the fact is that Remington has paved the way here for this scam to use insurance as the way. Because if you have to insure your weapons, own your weapons, you're going to have to register them in order to have them insured. And once they're registered, there's a position for the government to confiscate them.
Mandatory gun insurance. It'll be sort of like the mandatory car insurance.
Yes, that's exactly right. And as Dave Hodges observed years ago, in the 20th century, there were 19 democides, which is the wiping out, the slaughter of whole societies by their own governments, every one of which was preceded by gun confiscation. We cannot allow America to become number 20.
Well, you know, speaking of mass murders and democides and such, do you think the Ukraine war is breaking out at an extremely convenient time for the usual suspects whose master narrative about COVID and vaccines is crumbling? I mean, the Pfizer and Moderna's stock is just imploding even as we speak. And the truckers' protest is being emulated elsewhere, including here in the United States. It does seem that it's highly convenient for the usual suspects to suddenly have this war eclipse everything.
Well, yes, I agree that the Biden administration wants a distraction and that the war in Ukraine provides it. However, while it has been historically the case in the past that the American public has rallied around a president when the nation has been attacked, as occurred with W in the wake of 9/11, where his poll numbers were in the pits, and after 9/11 they rose to historic highs as much as 85%, which is incredible, given Biden's incompetence demonstrated during his withdrawal from Afghanistan, I believe the American public looks as this is just more incompetence on the part of Joe Biden. And let me point out, by the way, there's increasing awareness that Vladimir Putin has a point, that the U.S. broke its promise with regard to NATO. This is from the Los Angeles Times, Kevin, the Los Angeles Times. It's only a few paragraphs. Moscow solidified its hold on Crimea in April, outlawing the Tartar legislation that had opposed Russia's annexation of the region since 2014. Together with Russian military provocation against NATO forces in and around the Baltic, this move seemed to validate the observation of Western analysts who argue that under Vladimir Putin, an increasingly aggressive Russia is determined to dominate its neighbors and menace Europe. Leaders in Moscow, however, different story. For them, Russia is the aggrieved party. They claim the U.S. has failed to uphold a promise that NATO would not expand into Eastern Europe, a deal made during the 1990 negotiation between the West and the Soviet Union over German unification. In this view, Russia is being forced to forestall NATO's eastward march as a matter of self-defense. Get this. After the Berlin Wall fell, Europe's regional order hinged on the question of whether a reunified Germany would be aligned with the United States and NATO, the Soviet Union, and the Warsaw Pact, or neither. Policymakers in the George H.W. Bush administration decided in early 1990 that NATO should include the reconstituted German Republic. In early February of 1990, U.S. leaders made the Soviets an offer. According to transcripts of meetings in Moscow on February 9th, then Secretary of State James Baker suggested that in exchange for cooperation on Germany, the U.S. would make ironclad guarantees that NATO would not expand, quote, one inch eastward. Less than a week later, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev agreed to begin reunification talks. No formal deal was struck, but from all the evidence, the quid pro quo was clear. Gorbachev has ceded to Germany's Western alignment, and the U.S. would limit NATO's expansion, which, of course, we have grossly violated. Ukraine, Kevin, has become such a cesspool of corruption. And, of course, ironically, that's where Joe Biden and his son Hunter were basically plundering the country, where Biden, as vice president, declared the U.S. would withhold $1 billion in foreign aid unless they fired the prosecutor who was investigating Burisma, where Joe's unqualified son Hunter had a position on the board of directors for $50,000 or $80,000 a month.
Well, wait a minute, you wouldn't say Hunter's grifting is a vital national interest?
I love it, Kevin. And with your ability for satire and penetration, let me just make the following point. You've observed, you have differences with me about whether or not Sandy Hook happened, that you're not
I'm agnostic, and you definitely have your belief.
That's what I'm coming around to, that you're agnostic. But it doesn't matter if you're agnostic. It's not important to agree with me or not about Sandy Hook to recognize that is a fundamental principle of the American jurisprudence that no one may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. I was denied due process of law.
Well, Jim, this is the new world order, apparently, right? You just wrote something about how the Canadian government thinks it can now block people's access to their bank accounts because of their political activism.
Kevin, you're absolutely right, and that's why we have to fight this tooth and nail. So it's not just for the First and the Second Amendment, which make such a difference to our way of life, because they're going to use this case to compromise our ability to keep and bear arms by way of the insurance gambit, but it's depriving an American citizen of his right to due process to present a defense, which was grossly violated here. So if you believe this is a real threat to American jurisprudence and what this country is supposed to stand for, please check out GoSendMe.com Funding Fetzer. I would welcome your support. I have the law and the evidence on my side. What I need is the money. And if you can help me with the money, by God, I'm going to carry this to the Supreme Court and do my best to stand up for the rights of every one of us as American citizens.
Okay, so that's givesendgo.com. And these alternative platforms are springing up one after another. The big platforms are censoring and deplatforming people. But these new platforms are springing up. GiveSendGo is the fundraising platform that you're using. The truckers apparently were using it too. And I'm wondering if YouTube's having nuked all of these apparent evidentiary videos around Sandy Hook has led to those same videos popping up on places like Rumble and so on. Can people still see those videos? And if so, where?
Well, they can find a lot of them on places like 153news.net, on BitChute, Rumble, other places. You can use the Wayback Machine if you dig into it. If you reach out to some of those who've been around a long time here, they may be able to help you track them down. But some of them are just completely outrageous, like David Wheeler, who is supposed to have lost his son, played two roles, not only a grieving father, but also a SWAT member carrying a weapon upside down by the magazine on Dickinson Drive. It was
Are those videos still around? I know they were
I mentioned that because Mike Adams featured him carrying a weapon in his article about me as the most dangerous mind in America.
Now, wasn't he carrying the weapon wrong?
Oh, yeah. You don't carry a weapon upside down by the magazine. The magazines are made to be easily inserted and removed. So, I mean, this is something that I supervise recruit training with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command in repeated training cycles, Kevin. The least qualified recruit one commit this blunder. And get that. He was married to a woman named Francine Wheeler, who turned out to be the personal assistant to Marine White, who is a finance chairman for the Democratic Party. They both have acting credits. Barack Obama flew them knowing they were gun lobbyists to Washington, D.C., and had them give an impassioned speech from the Oval Office. Barack Obama was deeply involved in this. He nullified the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 by the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012, just in time to bring a Sandy Hook, where the Smith-Mundt Act precluded the use of the same techniques of propaganda and disinformation the CIA was using abroad from being used at home, stage shooting, fake riots, paying people to be crisis actors. Obama paved the way, and we've been suffering the consequences ever since.
Well, do you think, Jim, that they might break out another big, maybe even 9/11 scale false flag to enrage the American people enough to be willing to ratchet up the war on Russia in Ukraine? Now, Michael Rechtenwald in the first hour said he expects that the U.S. will actually go into Ukraine, maybe not boots on the ground, but definitely bombing, which, of course, is risking World War III. And I don't think American public opinion today is ready for it. As you say, people are very unimpressed with Biden's performance and mental acuity. But what if something terrible happened? Let's say there's a cyber attack that totally destroys all of our banking, all our gas station pumps can't function, nothing can function. A cyber attack has just wiped everything out. We're all like shivering in the cold, in the dark. And then somehow the lights come on and Biden says, Putin did this. Let's go get him.
I put it the other way around, Kevin. As long as we don't interfere here, and Putin's made it very clear that he's not going to tolerate any outside interference by NATO or the United States, I think we're okay. But if we seek to interfere, he could just ignite a bomb over the USA with its electromagnetic pulse that would wipe out all of our computerized components, and we'd be dead in the water.
That'd be better than a cyber attack, I guess.
They have far more sophisticated weaponry. You may recall the USS Donald, now they call it Donald Duck, was sitting in the Crimea when a Russian plane overflew, and they neutralized all the computerized components on the ship. Hundreds of Navy members got out because they could see the Russians were so far ahead of us. They have the best anti-missile missiles, the best anti-ship missiles. They have the best underwater torpedoes. These are virtually unstoppable. We do not want a war with Russia, Kevin, because we won't like the outcome.
Well, it's just obviously a terrible risk. And I mean, even if a tiny fraction of the U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons go off, we could be in for a nuclear winter, which would be a very, very miserable experience with a sizable fraction of the population dying of starvation within a few years. So it's obviously not something to mess around with. And so how are we going to get an anti-war movement going?
Well, the anti-war movement was zapped by Nixon when he eliminated the draft. That had kept the American public, the families, connected with issues of war and peace because they knew their sons or daughters would be at risk.
Yeah, and so it's hard for people to really imagine just how bad the risks are with nuclear war. But we're going to have to leave it at that because we hit the end of the hour. So thank you, Jim Fetzer. It's always great touching bases with you. And people can find that link to the Give, Send, Go fundraiser for your appeal to the Supreme Court by way of the radio blog for today, which is reachable through truthjihad.com. Click on the radio schedule link. Thanks again, Jim Fetzer. Take care.
My pleasure, Tim.
Yeah, bye-bye. Jim Fetzer, Kevin Barrett here. TruthJihad.com. Back again live next week. Jim Fetzer, Kevin. Revolution.radio.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution Radio.
Join me on the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Roux Show Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time.